If you were given a task to accomplish something and you needed 10 people to work on your team, would you rather take the 10 smartest people in the room to work with you, or would you rather take the 10 most disciplined people to work with you? Well, ideally, we'd like the 10 smartest people to also be the 10 most disciplined people. But unfortunately, the smartest people are not always the most disciplined people. Isaiah was not a disciplined person prior to Isaiah chapter 6, verse 4. In Isaiah chapter 6, verse 4, Isaiah is quoted there as saying, "Woe is me." Isaiah realized the fact that he'd been living an undisciplined life. He'd realized the fact that his self-esteem was soon being replaced with self-denial. And he realized that until he had a biblical view of sin, until he viewed sin the way that God views sin, he was not going to have a proper or correct view of himself. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 26, the Bible there talks about Christians as being weak and foolish and unimportant. But we are not weak and foolish and unimportant in the eyes of God. We are weak and foolish and unimportant in the eyes of the world. And we should always give thanks to God for what it is that he's done for us. There are a lot of people who have too high of a view of themselves and have too low of a view of both the Creator and of their brethren. We read about such a warning and such people in the 12th chapter of the book of Romans. And the 12th chapter of the book of Romans is going to be kind of the foundation for my thoughts this morning. It's going to kind of be the background that I'd like to spring off of. Now, I'm not going to do a verse-by-verse analysis of Romans chapter 12, but we are called to do a lot of things in Romans chapter 12. The first thing we're called to do in Romans chapter 12 is outlined for us in the first two verses there. Now, the first two verses of Romans chapter 12 are probably the most familiar verses to you, where it talks about us being a living sacrifice. Paul begins the chapter by telling us Christians that we are a living sacrifice. And he goes from there and he finishes the remainder of that chapter by telling us what it is that we have been called to do specifically. Beginning in verse 3, it says, "For through the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you, not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment." He gives a warning there right after he tells us about being sacrifices, that we are not to think more highly of ourselves than we ought to. And the reason he's giving us that admonition is because from verse 3 to verse 8, he's beginning to outline some gifts that we as Christians within the church may possess. Now, I say we may possess because I don't think the gifts listed from verse 3 to verse 8 are gifts that everyone within the church is going to possess, but I certainly think it is possible that some of us will possess some of these gifts. And if we are so blessed, we're to use these gifts as God has asked us to, and we're not to look upon these gifts as something to be proud of. Beginning in verse 9, through verse 13, there is a long list of things that all Christians have been called to do. There's a long list of things that we are expected to do. Now, in verses 3 through verses 8, we're talking about some special gifts there. A little bit different than the gifts we find in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 8, which were spiritual gifts, which were soon going to dissipate after the Bible in its written form came into full use. But in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11, we find there a list of four offices, two of which have passed on and are no longer in use, and two of the offices which were intended to remain through the existence of the church. Well, so it is with the gifts we find in Romans 12, verses 3 through 8. These gifts, by and large, have been designed to stay with us throughout the remainder of the church. But as I preface by saying not all of us are going to possess all of the gifts that we find in verses 3 through verse 8, the things asked of us from verses 9 through verse 13 are called upon all of us as Christians, whether we be male or female, whether we be young or old. All of these things outlined for us in verses 9 through 13 are things that we need to do. And it can be kind of a daunting list. Anytime somebody gives you a long list of things to do, it can be somewhat daunting. It can be somewhat overwhelming. And that brings me to what I'd like to talk to you about this morning. How is it as Christians that we can actually get all of this accomplished? Well, I submit to you the only way that we can fully accomplish the things outlined for us in Romans 12 is to be disciplined. And that brings me to what I'd like to talk to you about a little bit this morning. The disciplined life. How as Christians can we really accomplish much if we don't have discipline within our lives. Discipline is probably best defined as the ability to regulate one's conduct by principle and sound judgment, rather than by impulse, desire, or social custom. Now, I'd like to take a moment and just talk about a few characteristics that people outside the church or within the church who are self-disciplined tend to possess. One of the first things that disciplined people tend to possess is the fact that small things do in fact matter to them. And that's a biblical concept. In Song of Solomon chapter 2 verse 15 it says, "The little foxes that spoil the vineyards." Solomon, the wisest man who ever lived, understood the fact that the tiny details do matter. And if the tiny details go unchecked or unwatched, they can in fact bring about great destruction and great ruin. There's a little poem that came from the Middle Ages. I think it was King Richard who perhaps spoke about this. Talked about a man who for want of a nail didn't have a shoe, for want of a shoe didn't have a horse, for want of a horse lost his battle, for losing his battle he lost his kingdom. He lost his kingdom all because of a nail. Well, it's kind of a trite little saying, but it is in fact true that something as small as a nail for your horseshoe ended up causing this man his entire kingdom. And although that's a dramatic example, you will find that people who give special attention to small things ultimately accomplish the greatest things. A couple of other things that I think spiritually disciplined people, or disciplined people just in general, seem to possess is the fact that disciplined people don't spend all of their time trying to be entertained. Being entertained is not something that disciplined people have an obsession for. But disciplined people seek activities that are stimulating, that are challenging, and that bring about their creative nature. Entertainment in and of itself may not be wrong, but entertainment has a very small contribution to our well-being. And I'm ashamed to admit that I have spent a good majority of the last 10 years watching too much television or too many things that weren't necessarily sinful, or they weren't necessarily evil, but I will submit to you that they may have just been a waste of my time. I was seeking to be entertained all too often instead of engaging in activities or things that would be more to my benefit and to the benefit of others. A couple of other characteristic traits or qualities that I think disciplined people possess is the fact that disciplined people tend to be on time. And even in the book of Ephesians, the 5th chapter, Paul makes mention of this when he says, "Making the most of your time." Time is definitely a limited commodity, and how we allocate our time indicates to others how we allocate our priorities. And people who are disciplined make the use of their time. People who are undisciplined do not make use of their time. And you would be surprised, when you're disciplined, how much you can actually get done in a 24-hour day. It's not unlike doing a budget. A lot of times people don't realize how far their money actually can go until they put some sort of a plan together. And so it is with our time. The disciplined people understand this, and they make the most of their time. A couple of other things that disciplined people tend to do is they keep their word, they willingly accept correction from others, they practice self-denial, and they do not mind responsibility. The last thing on that list that I'd like to mention, a quality of a disciplined person, is that disciplined people tend to finish what it is that they start. Is your life nothing more than a long list of unfinished projects? Have you started a lot of things and rarely finished them? Well, I have to confess to you that my bookshelf is full of books that I have started and not finished. Now, there are various reasons why that has occurred. Occasionally, it's because I get into a book and realize that I just don't think it's time well spent. But far too often, it's just been the lack of self-discipline on my part that these things aren't finished. And there's nothing wrong with quitting a project when it's deemed no longer valuable. But when we quit simply because we lack discipline, I think that's something that we need to be cognizant of. Now, I understand that a lot of the things I've just listed are a lot of the things that CEOs and coaches and successful people in the world possess. There isn't necessarily anything spiritual about the list and the qualities that I've just spoken of. But I do think you cannot split your life into the secular and the spiritual. You must have every aspect of your life being towards the glory of God. Paul says as much for us in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 31. Self-discipline in the secular areas of your life, if you will permeate into the spiritual aspects of your life. And conversely, if we are undisciplined in the, quote, secular things of our life, we will more often than not be undisciplined in the spiritual things of our life, because I don't think they're totally inseparable. I do think they bleed into one another. And disciplined people tend to be disciplined in most areas of their life, and undisciplined people tend to be undisciplined in most areas of their life. Now, granted, I understand that we're not all disciplined in everything. We all have areas that we're undisciplined in. But I think disciplined people tend to have discipline across most aspects of their life. Now, the culture that we live in today, the United States, doesn't have much use for discipline at all. And I remember I had a history teacher about 12 years ago was making a comparison between the Roman Empire and that of the United States today. And he was talking about how the two societies mirror one another even to the tiniest examples. And when he told me this 12 years ago, I didn't think so much of it. But as time has passed and I've thought about it more, it's more and more amazing to me. He told me that it hasn't been since the Roman Empire ruled that a society has compensated its professional athletes to the degree that the United States has. And I understand that may just be a trite example to some, but I think it shows a further and a deeper example of how much the United States has become like the Roman Empire. America is losing sight of the need for discipline. There is little mental discipline amongst most of the people walking around the streets of our country today. But we instead are insisting on being entertained at every spare moment we can find. Richard Taylor wrote an excellent book about self-discipline. And one of the things he mentions in that book is the fact that 50 years ago, which some of you may remember better than I, for not having been alive 50 years ago, that in high schools, the greatest attractions were to the debates, were to the oral discourses of meaningful subjects. And when I was in high school some 12 years ago, I know that the largest attraction at our high school was the basketball games. And the debates were held in little classrooms down at the end of the hall. Well, our society hasn't always been like that. But our society is like that today. And I think that just indicates a shift in the superficiality and the overindulgence that our society has engaged itself in. Discipline has, in fact, been sacrificed at the altar of pleasure. And although we cannot do anything about society being that way, we certainly can do something about ourselves being that way. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 8 says, "For bodily exercise is profitable for a little." Nothing wrong with taking care of our bodies, nothing wrong with exercise. But we need to understand that the scriptures tell us that is profitable for a little. But mental discipline and the contemplation of spiritual things is profitable for much. The disciplined people have a balanced life. Discipline belongs to those who have a balanced life. If any of you who have ever met with someone to try and go over your retirement portfolio or to go over your finances or to go over investments or anything of that nature, one of the things that a good advisor will constantly bring to your attention is the fact that you need to have some balance, that you need to have some diversification, that you don't want to be one extreme or the other. And so it is with a disciplined person that they have balance in their life. They don't go to extremes. They don't waste a lot of time on one particular activity, but they manage their time and all things in their life in a balanced fashion. Now, being a disciplined person is not going to come about without paying a price. Warren Buffett, who is the second richest man in the United States, lives in Omaha, Nebraska, and he acquired his wealth through the years from investing money in Wall Street. And I was watching him on TV one night, and I'm going to go ahead and use my example of TV, even though I criticized it a moment ago. And as I was watching him one night, he was asked by the moderator what it is that he looks for in people that he employs in his company. And he drew the comparison of people to car engines. And he used the example that he would rather hire a six-cylinder engine that's firing on all six cylinders, then to hire an eight-cylinder engine that is only firing on four cylinders. His point being, he would rather hire a person with a little bit less talent that maximizes everything that he has than to hire the most talented person in the room who only operates at half of his ability. It's not an issue of being deficient in gifts for most people, because we're all gifted in some areas. But it's a character issue. It's a utilization of that gift. It's being disciplined to make the most of what it is that God has given you. God never judges a man by what he has, but he will judge a man by what he does with it. Now, one of the areas that I'm highly undisciplined, or was highly undisciplined in, was school. I despised school. I did not like school. You can go all the way back to first grade and look at some of my report cards, and you'll find teachers who have written things like uninterested, bored, underachiever. College and high school and grade school were not things that were ever of interest to me. I finished, barely, but that's about all I can say about my academic record. And why was that? It's because it wasn't fun for me. And I wasn't disciplined enough to understand that things aren't always fun, but you need to put your nose to the grindstone, you need to get it done. And I lacked that part of my character. That part of my character was lacking and flawed because I didn't want to do something that wasn't fun to me. But a disciplined person doesn't ask themselves, is it fun? A disciplined person asks himself, does this need to be done? And if the answer to the question, does it need to be done, is yes, then you see to it that it's done. The world is full of people with natural talent. We all have natural talent in one area or another. But there's only a few who truly excel in their natural talent. And the people who truly excel in their natural talent are the most disciplined people. I want to shift gears a little bit, and I want to talk a little bit more specifically about spiritual self-discipline. If I were to define spiritual self-discipline, I would define it as follows. To exercise self-discipline is to avoid evil by staying within the bounds of God's law. It's when we subordinate ourselves to the Word of God that we become a spiritually self-disciplined person. When we use God's Word to fully determine what is right or best for our life, we have begun the journey of becoming a spiritually self-disciplined person. If the church becomes undisciplined, the members which make up the church become undisciplined, then the message and the effectiveness of the church is going to be weakened, and the church will be susceptible to many things that are evil. Parents have to instill spiritual and self-discipline in general into their kids, and if their kids do wrong, they need to spank them until they understand that. They need to give them the discipline required, teach the children what it is that they should do, so they can be corrected, so that they can better their character. I look back at my childhood, and I can trace a lot of the things that I'm good at today to the discipline that I was given as a child. And conversely, some of the things that I have a weakness for today, or I'm not as disciplined in, I can trace that back to my childhood as well. But I don't blame my mom, because she did the best with what she had to work with. But let's go back to Romans chapter 12 a little bit, and let's just look over verses 9 through verses 13, and I'm not going to read them, but I want you to look over those verses there, and I want you to ask yourselves, which of those things do you excel in, and which of those things do you feel like you need a little bit of work, a little bit of help? Well, I doubt any of these things come easy to all of us. A few of them may, but it's only when we examine this list and understand what it is we need to work on, and we try and discipline ourselves, that we're going to have success accomplishing this. A minute ago, I talked about the fact that disciplined people pay attention to small things. And a lot of times, people think that Christians can get hung up over details and things of that nature that we can nitpick and so forth. And at times, that may be the case. But if we're being nitpicky, it may be an issue of the heart and not so much an issue of the fact that small things don't matter, because small things do matter. If you go out to Colorado, as I did as a child, and you see what they have out there called the Continental Divide, if I understand that properly, all of the rain that falls on one side of that divide will end up in the Pacific Ocean, and all of the rain that falls on the other side of that divide will end up in the Atlantic Ocean. And it's amazing how these two sides of this line are not that far apart. Yet the end result of where that rain ends up is thousands of miles apart. And that's not unlike our lives. We make a small adjustment here or there that's an error. Over time, we can find ourselves way off course. A pilot flying an airplane changes his course ever so slightly, and it won't be long before he's a long ways from where it was he intended to go. Charles Fry, I believe, a couple of winter studies ago, had an excellent quote that I'd like to share with you this morning. He said, "You can't rock the boat if you're busy rowing." And I think that's an excellent thing for all of us within the church to keep in mind. You can't rock the boat if you are busy rowing. And the disciplined people are the people who are generally busy rowing. I was reading not long ago about Brother Zur, and I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with Brother Zur, having his commentary that was written in 1946. And as Brother Zur was putting that commentary together, I found it interesting that he worked on that commentary 6 days a week. And each day, he would get up before 4 o'clock, down a few strong cups of coffee, and he would work on that commentary from 4 o'clock until 8 o'clock every single morning for 6 days a week until that commentary was finished. That is truly an example of discipline and spiritual self-discipline within one of our brethren. Galatians chapter 4, verse 18 says, "It is fine to be zealous, provided the purpose is good." And when we think about discipline and we think about being spiritually self-disciplined, if we just keep in mind the fact that we are God's, that we have been saved through the blood of Christ, that when we allow sin to enter into our lives, that it's violating our relationship with God, I think that will help us and motivate us to become spiritually self-disciplined. Because discipline doesn't come without motivation. Men don't oftentimes worry about what they put into their bodies until they have a heart attack. And if they're fortunate enough to survive the heart attack, they become extremely disciplined in walking every morning and avoiding fatty foods and things of that nature. It's because they've been scared. It's because they now have motivation to be disciplined. Well, when we understand our relationship with God and we understand what God's done for us, I think that can be our motivation to be disciplined. Looking back in Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, the King James Version there talks about the imaginations of the men, or the heart, or the intents and the heart of men became evil. And that is ultimately why God destroyed the world with the flood. It's because men's minds had become depraved and had become evil. In the Old Testament, when it talks about hearts, it often means a person's mind. And in a person's mind is where our battle is won or lost. James chapter 1, verse 14 talks about this. When lust is conceived, it brings forth sin, which ultimately will lead to death. These battles are fought within our mind more than they are fought anywhere else. And it's incumbent upon each and every one of us to discipline ourselves mentally as well as physically if we are to be on the right path for the Lord. David touches upon this in Psalm 19 and 14 when he says, "Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord." It's important that we understand the battle is in fact fought in our mind. And we train our conscience to either excuse things or to convict them. But the right decision will be made by our conscience only as we have trained our conscience to recognize sin and to recognize evil. It's never an issue of where you live, because Christians have fought these battles since the beginning of time. It's a matter of you training your mind in the proper way. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13 says, "Therefore gird up your minds." He's basically saying there, you need to discipline your mind. We have many other passages in the New Testament that talk about discipline. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 27 talks about the fact that we need to beat our body, that we need to beat our body and discipline it so that we can serve the Lord. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1 talks about laying aside the weight that so easily entangles and encumbers us. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 14 talks about the loins of truth and how we have to have this discipline within our life if we are in fact going to be the best possible servant of the Lord that we can. Back to 1 Peter chapter 1 there, he talks about keeping sober. Keeping sober is nothing more than tying up all those loose ends. Keeping sober is nothing more than having a clear mind. It's having a mind that is focused, that is clear, and that understands the task. That is what keeping sober means as we find it in the New Testament. And that is why sound doctrine is so important. Because when we have sound doctrine, we have a starting point for our discipline. You can't have discipline without a starting point and without motivation. And we have passages like 1 Peter 1:14, 1 Corinthians 6:19, Acts 20 and 28, Galatians 3 and 13 that talk about the fact that we have in fact been purchased by the blood of Jesus Christ and what a value that is to us, that we recognize that. And until this is understood, spiritual self-discipline will not occur in our lives. Now there's one point I'd like to make before I wrap this up this morning. And that is the fact that discipline does not equal holiness. I think oftentimes there is a tendency, if we're not careful, to feel like if we become extremely disciplined in something, that somehow that equates to us being holy or righteous. And discipline does not equal holiness, although I will submit to you that undiscipline does not equal holiness either. Let's look at what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5, verse 20. Matthew chapter 5, verse 20, Jesus there says, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." Now the word righteousness in the New Testament has three different meanings as best I can tell. In Acts chapter 7, verse 52 there, Stephen, as he is nearing death, talks about the righteousness of God, or the righteousness of Jesus. Paul also writes about that in Romans chapter 3, verse 10, when he says, "There is none righteous." It's an absolute righteousness that Jesus Christ possessed that none of us ever will. But in Acts chapter 10, Cornelius is described as a righteous man. And I think righteousness there means relatively righteous. He was a good man. He was a good man, although he was not yet saved. He was a good man. And the third form of righteousness that we find in the New Testament is a self-perceived righteousness. That's the kind of righteousness that the Pharisees struggled with. That's the kind of righteousness that said, everyone else is sick, everyone else needs spiritual help, but I don't. In Acts chapter 26, verse 5, it talks about the discipline of the Pharisees. And that's why I said a little bit ago, discipline does not equal holiness, because nobody was as disciplined as the Pharisees. Paul even says as much in Acts 26, verse 5, that according to the strictest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. If discipline in and of itself equaled holiness, there would have been none holier than the Pharisees. Yet we know the Pharisees were condemned for a multitude of things. They were condemned for their doctrine. They were condemned for their hypocrisy. They were condemned for being covetousness. They were condemned because they put more emphasis on the outer form than they did on the inner purity. They were condemned because they were more concerned with human tradition than they were with divine commandment. But more than any other thing, I think the Pharisees were chastised for their self-righteousness. And we need to make sure that as we try and discipline ourselves, as we try and become better servants of the Lord, we do not begin to think of ourselves in a self-righteous manner. Now, a Pharisee doesn't mean that you have strong convictions. Because you have strong convictions doesn't make you a Pharisee. Because you're keeping commandments doesn't make you a Pharisee. Because you're condemning error and those people who are peddling the error doesn't make you a Pharisee. But if you are a self-righteous person who has hypocrisy and the other things that I've spoken of, then we may have our discipline channeled in the wrong direction and with the wrong heart. Our discipline can only serve us if it's matched up with the heart that is in the right place. Jesus never challenged the Pharisees for raising the legitimate objections. He chastised the Pharisees because they were raising these objections with the wrong motivation and with the wrong thoughts in their hearts. They were constantly trying to trap Jesus. They were not honestly seeking the truth and the answers to their questions. We are all forgiven sinners, and we must always keep that in mind, no matter how disciplined we may become in our walk with the Lord. Even the most disciplined among us was at one time a sinner, and if it was not for Jesus Christ, would still be. I was at Gregor Boulevard a couple of weeks ago, and one of the brethren there gave an excellent lesson, and he made a statement in his sermon that I've been thinking about a lot for the last couple of weeks. And the idea of his sermon was just talking about individual responsibility in the worship service. And he posed the question that he thinks all of us should perhaps ask ourselves as we're leaving the auditorium this morning and on any other Lord's Day. And that is, we need to all ask ourselves, how did you worship today? How did we worship today? How did I worship today? We don't need to worry about whether or not the speaker did a nice job or whether or not the song service was as good as it could have been. We need to ask ourselves, how was our worship today? And if there are problems with the song service or if there are problems with the speakers, we have appointed elders who have been ordained by God and set in place by God to handle these things. But these aren't things that you and I need to weigh in on, because it's not our responsibility. We and ourselves are our primary responsibility. And it's not our job to critique everybody and critique everything that's done in the public forum. It's not our job to write the Monday morning column and give 1.5 out of a 4 possible Bibles in our critique in our column. That's not our job. Our job is to encourage, and our job is to ask ourselves, how did we worship? We need to discipline ourselves and not worry about whether or not our brethren are disciplined or not, because we have a big enough task bringing ourselves under control. As I mentioned at the beginning, back in the 6th chapter of the book of Isaiah, Isaiah was described as a man with unclean lips. Isaiah is described there as an undisciplined person. And then he finds what it is that the Lord asks him to do, and he says, "Woe to me." He understood that the undisciplined life wasn't going to be a life that took him where he wanted to go. And he brought himself to have a disciplined life, and he brought himself to have a life that was in obedience with the will of the Lord. Revelations chapter 22 and verse 14 in closing says, "Blessed are they that do his commandments, that they may have the right to the tree of life, and may enter in through the gates into the city."